Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
People are brainwashed. They're propagandized. They hear the same thing over and over and over for years and years and years. So they don't think. They just say, oh, we can't do that. But you can do it. You used to do it. Before you got roped into the euro, you had your own central bank, your own money. You can do it again. And if the Russians are giving them the opportunity, if they don't take it, then they deserve whatever happens to them, as far as I'm concerned.
That's today's very special guest, Paul Craig Roberts, talking about how the Greeks, perhaps like the rest of us, have a chance to break free of the global monetarists that have been sucking our economies dry. We have an extended visit with Roberts today, a former assistant treasury secretary to Ronald Reagan, as he delivers a no-holds-barred straight talk about who is running the global show. But now, here's Ellen.
Thanks, Will. Well, the news out of Europe this week is that Greece has been strong-armed into accepting the EU's onerous loan terms after all, forcing yet more austerity on the all-suffering Greeks. Or at least that's the way it appears. Or perhaps they are just buying time while they get their ducks in a row. We'll be talking about that more with our illustrious guest, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. But first, I thought I would discuss something I just posted an article on called Capital Appreciation Bonds, also called Payday Loans for School Districts. The reason I researched it was that I was giving a presentation a couple of weeks ago in Santa Ana in Orange County, California, along with Richard Wolff, who gave a great presentation himself. And I knew that capital appreciation bonds were a big problem for Orange County, and so I wanted to incorporate them into my PowerPoint. So I did a little research, and it seems that various cities in Orange County had fallen for these bonds in which they would, after 40 years, be paying out 15 times principal or 10 times principal or 13 times principal or 7 times, huge sums. The catch is that you don't pay anything over 35 or 40 years, and then at the end of the period, you have this massive balloon payment. Well, that could actually bankrupt these cities, as Orange County is already somewhat infamous for getting into solvency issues. So the question is, why did the school boards bite on these deals? They go back to 2009 when Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor and California had debt problems after the 2008 crisis, and the state could no longer make the sort of advances to the school districts that they used to do, and that the tax base was shrinking. And so a bill was passed that lifted the debt ceiling on the long-term bonds, the long-term loans that school districts could enter into. And so it's the nature of these bonds that they don't have to pay month after month or year after year. So they don't have to go to the taxpayers and raise taxes. So it looked like a good deal. They needed these facilities, or they thought they did, a new school or a new gymnasium or a new swimming pool or a new auditorium. And they wouldn't have to pay anything for now. So you wonder if some people say, well, there must have been some payola involved or something. It must be corruption. But there were 400 school districts that bought into these bonds. And it's hard to believe that many school districts are corrupt. And typically, people who run for school boards are parents who are worried about their children and their grandchildren. They wouldn't do that to their grandchildren intentionally. So it seems to me it must have been in the way these bonds were sold, that it was the bankers' lobby that pushed for the bill in the first place. And of course, as soon as it passed, they were roaming all over the state pushing these bonds on these school districts. So I think what the real catch is just the nature of compound interest. I looked to see what sort of interest would result in having to pay out 20 times principal, which was what the highest of these capital appreciation bonds resulted in, or 15 times principal or 10 times principal, what kind of interest rate that would be. So if you project it over 40 years, a mere 6% interest rate comes out to 10 times principal over 40 years if you don't pay anything until the very end. Or if it's only 8%, like only 2% more than 6%, you wind up paying 22 times principal over 40 years. So that's just the way these compound interest curves grow. Is the exponential function, which the mathematical function Einstein called compound interest, the greatest force in the world, or at least that is attributed to him. And it, whether he said it or not, it does sound like, I mean, it has the ring of truth. So then I was thinking, I wonder what sort of loans you could get in North Dakota, where they have the Bank of North Dakota, which is a publicly owned bank. And sure enough, just last December, the Bank of North Dakota made a loan for a school at 1% interest over 20 years. And so I looked up the compound interest charts on that. If you borrow $1 at 1% interest in 20 years, you will owe back $1.22, a mere $1.22. And if it's over 40 years, you will owe back $1.48. So that's just how compound interest goes. If it's a low interest rate, the curve grows very gradually. You're not at the point yet where the curve is aiming skyward after 40 years. But if you have a higher interest rate, it goes skyward much, much faster. And then the question is, how is it that the Bank of North Dakota can afford to make these low interest loans? And the answer is that they have very low costs. They have no high-paid executives. The highest-paid executive, I think, is the president, who makes, last I looked, $240,000 a year. Compare that to $20 million, which is what the president of Wells Fargo makes. They don't pay bonuses, fees, or commissions. They don't pay dividends to private shareholders. They have low borrowing costs. They don't have to advertise for depositors. They have a built-in deposit base with the state's revenues. By law, all the state's revenues are deposited in the Bank of North Dakota. They don't have losses from gambling and derivatives. They don't do derivatives as a form of money making. So that's a very good deal for the North Dakota citizens. And the state of North Dakota has a population of only 740,000 people, which is the size, as it happens, of the cities of Santa Ana and Anaheim, its sister city, neighbor city, combined. So if just those two cities were to join up and form a municipally owned bank, they too could be funding their schools at 1% interest and avoid the payday loan trap of the Wall Street vampire squids. But enough of that. It's now time to talk to our venerable guest, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts.
It is my great honor and pleasure to be talking to Paul Craig Roberts, an economist who served as Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy in the Reagan administration and was a co-founder of Reaganomics. He is the author of 12 books and is a former editor and columnist for The Wall Street Journal and Business Week, among other publications, and has held academic appointments at a number of universities, including Stanford and Georgetown. He is currently chairman of the Institute for Political Economy. In 2011, Octopus Post named Dr. Roberts one of the 10 most influential people in the alternative media. So I'll just read this quote, which I thought was cool. His research is impeccable, and his vision of how the world really operates is second to none. He knows why and when the global chess pieces are moving and has the incredible talent to communicate difficult concepts to the general public. There is no one better at reporting the reality of geopolitical events and the workings of the Treasury and the Federal Reserve. So he's a man with lots of answers. Greetings, Dr. Roberts. It's great to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much, Ellen. I hope that in this interview I can live up to that introduction.
Oh, no, you've already lived up to it. I totally agree and concur with all of that. So you're an expert on so many things that I'd be asking you questions all day if I had the chance. But I thought I'd like to start with Greece because it's the hot topic of the week, and I'm a bit confused myself on what just happened there. You've written a lot and spoken a lot about it. So did Syriza completely capitulate, or are they holding back some cards that we're not seeing?
Well, I don't know. I think that the Greek finance minister and the prime minister, indeed I would say the entire new government, they understand that the conditions that have been imposed on Greece simply cannot be met. In order to put that kind of austerity would essentially impoverish half of the population. Mm-hmm. And moreover, what the austerity does, it drives down the economy because it drives down consumer spending, investment spending, government spending. And as we've known since John Maynard Keynes wrote the general theory in the 30s, in the 1930s, those are the three determinants of the gross domestic product. So if you drive down all the determinants of GDP, then the existing debt becomes a larger percentage as the GDP shrinks. And that's what has been happening in Greece. The austerity they have already imposed, that they're already suffering from, has resulted in the debt rising as a share of GDP. And to increase this austerity would just simply make that even worse. And so it's impossible then for the conditions to be met. Now, the Germans and apparently the relevant parties in the EU are not prepared to acknowledge reality. And the reason, I believe, for this unwillingness to acknowledge reality is that the Greek sovereign debt crisis is being used for something other than repayment of the debt. I've identified two purposes of this debt crisis or the austerity. One is to establish the precedent that banks are not liable for their own mistakes. If they overlend to a country, they no longer have to write down that part of the debt that cannot be paid in order that that part of the debt can be paid is paid. Instead, the mistakes of the financial system are imposed on the general population. They have to have their old age pensions cut, their social services cut, such as health care, education. They have to lose jobs. The government has to fire thousands and thousands of public employees. They have to sell off for pennies on the dollar to clients of the banks, their bank creditors, public assets such as municipal water companies, the ports, the Greek islands that are in the National Preserve, to real estate developers. And all of that money then is used to repay the International Monetary Fund, which has paid off Greece's creditors. So that's one of the purposes. It's no longer is the financial system accountable for its own mistakes. The general population of the indebted country is accountable. Now, the second purpose of this crisis, which is the only reason it is a crisis, is that the refusal to allow a write-down of the debts that can't be paid. Now, that's the normal way, traditionally, to deal with this type of crisis. So that is being changed. The second purpose of it, then, is to establish...
Can I just stop you there? You say that's the normal way. So with countries, that's the normal way? I mean, that's been done,
yeah,
like, traditionally?
Traditionally, that part of the debt that's excessive and can't be paid is written down so that rest that can be paid is paid. So people take haircuts. You know, we've heard about haircuts.
Right.
Now, of course,
the bondholders. So I suppose the difference is this is the Troika. It's the IMF, which never gives an inch, I guess.
Yeah. Well, they're changing. You see, they're changing this because the banks rule. I mean, you've made this point yourself. The banks rule. And so they're saying, well, we can shove all the cost of our own mistakes off on the populations of countries. And so that's one aspect of it. Now, the second aspect is probably just as important and maybe even more important to the EU. This crisis is being used to subvert the remaining sovereignty of the countries. In other words, in the case of Greece, we see that they have the government of Greece no longer has any control over its own budget policy, its own budget. It can't decide how much it's going to spend, where it's going to spend it, how much public support it's giving. So the outcome of this crisis is to expand the power of Brussels over the remaining sovereignty of the governments of the member states of EU. And as I wrote in one of my books the last year or two, Trichet, who was the previous head of the European Central Bank, was explicit about this. He stated this explicitly, that this is what this is being used for, and I quote him at length, that the European Union is taking a further step toward integration, this time political integration, which means the subservience of the fiscal policies of the member states to Brussels. So those are the two things that are going on in Greece. And it's the reason that the Germans and the EU, or the Troika, whatever you want to call them, are adamant not to adjust the program that it's forcing on Greece, even though it can't possibly be met, these conditions, or beyond the economic ability of the Greek people, the Greek government to meet. So what happened the other day in the showdown meeting? I think that, I don't know if the Greeks actually thought that the Germans and the Troika would be realistic and come to their senses. Maybe they did. Maybe they thought that just the power of the facts would convince them. If they thought that, they were delusional. And so they may have found themselves in a situation where the money is cut off right now unless we agree to this four-month extension. Well, we can agree to 4 months and then and figure out what to do in that period of time, because it's very hard to figure out what to do when you haven't got 10 seconds. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so
apparently,
it could well be that what looks like a capitulation was simply the only way they could gain any sort of time to figure out. Now, of course, by today, the Greek government is supposed to have come up with additional austerity measures that it would impose. And they could come up with these measures, but still not deliver on them. We have to keep in mind that if the new government in Greece is aware, as I'm sure they are, that Greece cannot fulfill these conditions without starving the population and producing, you know, massive social, political, economic dislocations, perhaps the government has in mind the offer that the Russians made. They said, we'll finance you. Join our trade system. Join our Eurasian trade system. We'll finance you. And, of course, China is a strategic partner with Russia, and the BRICS Bank, I think, is now more or less created. This has $100 billion, according to news reports. So here is an opportunity for the Greeks to retrieve the situation if they can come to some agreement with the Russians or the Chinese or the BRIC bank.
I had read about the Eurozone or the EU that they knew when they put it together that they were trying to join all these countries into a monetary system, and they knew that it would require political joinder as well in order to make it work, and they thought that the politics would follow the monetary union. But the problem is, I mean, like even in the U.S., we have all these states that finally that gave up their sovereignty and agreed not to print their own money and let the federal government print the money. But the federal government, in turn, agreed to do all sorts of things for the people, like we have national social security and, you know, different national social programs. Whereas if, I mean, how can they in the Eurozone just say, you know, you have to succumb to our political direction, but we're not going to give you any programs, or we're not going to help you in any way. You have to help us, but we're not going to help you. I mean, it just sounds totally Orwellian.
Well, Ellen, it's the opportunity that the indebtedness, the inability to service the debt, gives to the EU to consolidate power, and so that's what they're using it for, because they've deceived and tricked the various countries into a common currency, mm-hmm. so that the central banks of the individual countries no longer are central banks, because mm-hmm. they can't finance the government. They can't right. issue bonds in their own currency. So the
different
monetary
proposals.
Policy is already taken. Now, if they ever manage to subvert the fiscal policies of the various members of the EU, then they may start having some common social security or whatever. But just to finish the point, if Greece were to come to a deal with the Russians or the Russian alliance, they could just default. They could just say, well, look, you've been so unrealistic. You know perfectly well we can't meet these terms, so we're not going to pay any of it. We were willing to pay some of it, but now we're not going to pay any. Go to hell.
So that's a good point. They could play along for 4 months and then still default and just say, we renege. We're not going
to
agree.
Well, they've got 4 months, apparently, to make a deal with the Russians. Now, the Russians and Chinese, if Greece leaves the euro, that means they leave the EU.
Right.
Well, what do you think Italy and Spain are going to do? Because they face the same austerity that's been imposed
right.
on Greece. So the Italians and the Spanish, they'd likely say, well, we'd like to join you too. Take us too. And so then the American empire in Europe starts unraveling. In other words, this is a strategic victory for Russia and China
mm-hmm.
if they simply make this loan to Greece and say, look, we'll support you, renege. Just reneging on the debt would cause financial panic in Europe and would take a tremendous amount of the pressure off of Russia from, the United States has made its NATO vassal states impose on Russia. So the financial crisis, if Greece says, well, we're not paying any of this, look at all the banks that are on the hook, no doubt including U.S. ones, and hedge funds who bought up the debt at rock-bottom prices expecting, you know, it to be paid off at face value. So this is a way for Russia and China to strike back at their enemy who's doing so much to damage them. And certainly, if Greece can get no consideration whatsoever from its fellow Europeans, why should it stay in that relationship?
Right.
So I think the story is not over.
Well, that's what I was wondering. something we're not seeing. Since you mentioned Russia, I have the same sort of questions about Russia. I mean, obviously, they're being provoked, trying to provoke them into a world war, but they're not taking the bait. So what's going on behind the scenes there? Are they planning to join up with China and form their own monetary union? Is that why they're selling off their dollars for gold?
The Russians and Chinese, I think, have formed a strategic, economic, and military alliance. And, of course, they are taking it beyond themselves because they have this organization known as the BRICS, which includes India, Brazil, and South Africa. And I would imagine more and more countries will want to be part of that because of the risk of being in the American system. If you're in the American system, you can't have an independent foreign policy or an independent economic policy. You have to follow what the Americans want you to do, or you suffer consequences. And so I think the BRICS could expand and draw more of the world into it. For example, Argentina, Bolivia, Ecuador, Venezuela, and the others. Because anybody who doesn't follow Washington's policy is subject to being destabilized economically, politically, both, assassinations. And so to get out of the dollar-based system is being seen as a virtue. So I think that we see already the Russians turning to the east, the big gas deals with China, the statement of the Chinese financial office that we don't think Russia needs any help, but if they do, they'll get it from us.
Mm-hmm.
We see the rerouting of the natural gas pipeline, which currently goes through Ukraine. That's going to be closed down. And natural gas is going to go to Turkey and stop. And Gazprom has told Europe, if you want to buy gas, you'll have to build a pass. You'll have to build a pipeline to the Turkish-Greek border and connect. So, in other words, Gazprom has given Europe 2 years, and the gas is off, unless Europe has a pipeline there. Putting the pipeline to Turkey, this now has brought a NATO ally into alliance with Russia. And bringing the pipeline junction to the Turkish-Greek border hands cards to Greece. So it really depends on the intelligence of the Greek people. The current government is essentially hamstrung. Two reasons. One, though the election did give them the government, it only gave them 37% of the vote. Now, that was a lot larger than the other parties, but it's not the kind of vote that would intimidate the EU. If 60 or 70% of the Greeks had had enough sense to vote for this party, then the EU would be much more accommodating because it would realize that not a third of the population, but two-thirds of the population is behind this government. So that's one mistake the Greek people made. The other mistake the Greek people have made is polls show that the largest percentage of the population, much more than majority, want to remain in the EU.
Mm-hmm.
So if the new government has got to remain in the EU, then it really hasn't any bargaining cards with the Troika. So until the Greek people themselves become intelligent and realize the situation, it's hard for the government to do anything. I think it could get away with making a deal with the Russians and just announcing it. I think that the relief on the part of the people that their pensions are not going to be further cut, that employment's not going to be further cut, that the minimum wage is not going to be further cut, that their health services are not going to be further cut, that their beautiful islands are not going to be handed over to real estate investors, I think they would accept the government making the decision, regardless of whether the population wanted to remain in the EU. And, of course, the only reason they won't remain in the EU is they've been brainwashed for 30 years. They can't make it on their own. If you're not in the EU, it's all over for you. Well, this is crazy. I mean, they're in the EU, and look, it's all over for them.
Right.
They're being driven into the ground. They're not gaining anything for being in the EU. Now, sooner or later, the people it has to connect in their mind. And it's unfortunate it's taken Greek people so long to even be aware of the situation that they're in. In that sense, they're like Americans who haven't a clue of the situation that they're in. So,
yeah, I know somebody who's Greek and who's been there recently, and he said that's like you said, that there are many people that are still wealthy. I mean, it's not everybody who is jobless, and they don't want to lose what they've got, and so they're still fighting for the old system.
Yeah, but that's a tiny percentage. I mean, you know, the unemployment rate there is horrendous, and for the youth, it's 50% or more.
True,
I mean,
but they still have to
battle. We're talking about conditions right now in Greece that are worse than the depth of the American Great Depression.
Right.
And the additional austerity that the Troika is demanding will make them even worse.
We're speaking with Paul Craig Roberts, the noted commentator, author, professor, and presidential advisor to Ronald Reagan.
So, your latest of 12 books was published last year, and it's called How America Was Lost, From 9/11 to the Police Warfare State. So how was America lost? The neocons took over the Republican Party somewhere between Reagan and Bush. How did that happen? You were there, so I just wondered how it looked from your position.
Well, everything is different post-Soviet collapse of 1991. And Reagan was long gone. In the Reagan period, the neoconservatives were able to sell themselves to the traditional conservatives that they have now eliminated and replaced. They could sell themselves to traditional conservatives as anti-communist. And so since the origin of the neoconservatives was the left wing, many of them were Trotskyites.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that these left-wing intellectuals were on the side of conservatives, being anti-communist, this took the sting away of the liberal charge that, oh, these conservatives are anti-communist, they're anti-communist, The conservatives got tired of hearing all that, and so here's all these left-wingers, they want to join us. So that's how they got in. Now, they didn't last long in Reagan administration because they concocted things like the Iran-Contra. They were trying to have an assertive policy toward the Soviet Union that Reagan wanted only in words. Reagan wanted to have it in words in order to bring the Soviets to a negotiating table and negotiate the end of the Cold War. Reagan was always concerned about the dangers of a nuclear war, and so he wanted to end the conflict. Well, for Reagan, his solution was first we cure our own economy, because we had stagflation at the time. And if you don't remember that, what was happening was that the trade-offs between employment and inflation were worsening. So if you wanted to reduce the rate of unemployment, you had to pay a higher and higher price in terms of inflation. If you wanted to try to reduce the inflation rate, you had to pay a higher and higher price in terms of the unemployment rate. And so the whole system was just ceasing to work, the kind of post-World War II Keynesian demand management economic policy had failed. It just wouldn't perform anymore. And so that's where I came in. You know, it wasn't Reaganomics, it was supply-side economics. And Reagan saw that we had a solution, nobody else did, so he put us in charge of domestic economic policy. And we solved the stagflation. It went away. You've not heard about it since. Well, Reagan's idea was if we solve that.
How was it solved then?
We reversed the policy mix. What was happening, what the Keynesians we're doing, we're driving up consumer demand with monetary policy, but restricting the response of supply with high tax rates.
Ah.
And so we just reversed it. We said we want to. So you see, Keynesians did not understand that fiscal policy directly affected the supply side of the economy. They thought it only affected consumer demand or business demand. And that was the big gap in their model that we filled. It took a while, but eventually Paul Samuelson acknowledged in his textbook that we were right. So that's how that happened. But the important thing
I still don't quite understand that. I think I would be a demand side economist. I mean, I think we need more money out there, but the money needs to get into the pockets of the people who would buy the goods. Right now, they use quantitative easing and purport to be getting money out there, but it never gets past the balance sheets of the banks. So I'm not sure what supply side versus demand side, what that means.
Well,
I mean, I can see supply that you help the suppliers by reducing
so many times, but I can try to do it for you again here. If you have only a demand side, then you think.
But are we doing demand side right now? I don't think we are we?
Well, right now, Ellen, we're not doing anything.
Right.
There's no economic policy for the country. There's only covering the bank's bad debts. So
right.
The entirety of American economic policy right now is to cover the debts the banks can't cover, either through the taxpayers or the central bank. This is a new development. It came out of the 2007-08 crisis.
Mm-hmm.
It actually came out of the deregulation. It goes back to Bill Clinton.
Yeah, well, that was another question I had, was where did that whole trillion or quadrillion dollar derivatives thing come from? That was obviously a failure of regulation, but who let that happen, or what was the reasoning behind all that?
Well, don't you remember?
I know that.
Glass-Steagall. Head of the Commodity Futures Trading Corporation. Her federal mandate was to regulate over-the-counter derivatives. When she tried to do what she was supposed to do, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, the Secretary of the Treasury, the Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, and the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission stopped her. And they went to mm-hmm. Congress and said, if this woman regulates these derivatives, it'll ruin the economy. Markets are self-regulating. Don't you remember this? This was a big thing, and she had to resign. And so the markets, the derivatives, have no regulation. They did other things as well. They took position limits off of speculators. And in my day, speculation could not dominate a commodity market. Or any market. Well, today they can dominate any market. So all these things were post-Reagan. We didn't have any such ideas.
Mm-hmm. How do you mean? That's interesting. So speculation couldn't dominate markets. There was a rule? Was speculation illegal?
Of course, there was position limits on speculation. You know, Mark Tabby, the guy that writes in Rolling Stone, he's explained this brilliantly mm-hmm. and clearly in his articles, but mm-hmm. they got rid of, the purpose of speculation traditionally has been to smooth imbalances between supply and demand over time, not to dominate the market or determine, the outcome. But when you take the position limits off, I think what it was, here I'm relying on memory. I think the position limits of speculation could never be more than 15% of the market. But today they could be the entire market. I mean, Goldman Sachs can go raise hundreds of billions of dollars and go in and dominate any market. So now to get back to the supply side policy, the Keynesian policy used monetary policy to stimulate consumer demand. But the very high tax rates on labor and on investment income discouraged the increase in labor supply and in investment to meet the rising consumer demand caused by monetary policy. And so the prices would go up. In other words, when you get more consumer demand in the economy, one or two or both things have to happen. Either the prices go up or the output goes up or some combination of both. And what was happening was because of the high tax rates on investment income. For example, the depreciation allowances on businesses were so long and drawn out that it was impossible for any business to recover its capital investment through depreciation. And so this affected the rates of return. And people would say, well, there are risks in this. Let's just let the price go up. Why do we want to go to all this trouble? And with labor, you saw all kinds of new developments where people wouldn't show up for work on Monday, and doctors wouldn't show up for work on Friday. They'd rather go to the golf course because marginal tax rates are taxes on additions to income. So as the income mounts, the tax rate mounts. And at some point, people say, well, you know, the leisure is worth more to me than the additional after-tax income. It's so little. Or they would, and it also affects the saving consumption ratio. People would say, the after-tax return I get on my savings through my investments is so low, I'd rather spend the money now and enjoy the consumption. So that's what we did. We changed that so that the supply had more incentives to respond
to demand.
How was demand
then driven up by Keynesian economics?
Monetary expansion.
As in printing money?
Not anything like printing money like they do now. It's a different purpose now. And it's called deficit spending. It was a government would run a deficit, then the central bank would expand the money supply to accommodate the deficit. So that's the way the monetary expansion would work. Now, you can always, and as Milton Friedman always made clear, you need a growing money supply. But what you don't need is a money supply growing faster than the real economy. And that's how the Keynesians ended up, for the reasons I gave you. So we had to correct that, and we did. And that's just a matter of record. And once corrected, Reagan now said, I've got the economic power to put pressure on the Soviets to come to the bargaining table because their economy hasn't got a solution, and they are in dire straits. We are out of our dire straits. So Reagan started all this bluff. Oh, we're going to have Star Wars. We're going to build up the military. It's mainly talk, but what the neocons wanted was action. They wanted it really to happen. They wanted to not end the Cold War, but to win it. They wanted a Soviet defeat at the hands of the United States. So they got out of control. Reagan fired them all. Many of them were prosecuted. Some of them were sentenced. Even the Secretary of Defense, Weinberger, was about to be indicted. And it was George Herbert Walker Bush who pardoned them. And I can understand why he would do it, because they were seen as, well, maybe they went too far and all that, but they're really fighting the Soviets, and how can we punish them for fighting the Soviets? So that's the first appearance of the neoconservatives wasn't very successful, other than they made a lot of new contacts, and they got anti-communists on their side, feeling sorry for them for getting fired and prosecuted. And they reappeared. I don't think they had any influence to speak of in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. That was traditional Republicans who are now gone. But they reemerged in Clinton. They're responsible for the American attack on Yugoslavia, the American attack on Serbia. The beginning of this type of illegal war crimes being committed by Washington in the name of spreading democracy. And then, of course, with George W. Bush, it went berserk. And so 9/11 was what let them go forward with all their position papers. If you read the position papers, you'll see they already had a scheme for invading all of the Middle Eastern countries. And they said, what we need in order to go forward with this is a new Pearl Harbor. Well, 9/11 provided the Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And it also provided the grounds for the beginning of a domestic police state, because the argument was given that, oh, we can't keep you Americans safe unless we curtail your rights. We have to take away habeas corpus and have indefinite detention without evidence presented to a court. We have to take away due process. We have to spy without warrants. And then Obama added, I can kill you on suspicion alone without due process. Kill American citizens. So this put in place a domestic police state known as the Department of Homeland Security. While we're talking right now, they're recording this. This is recording. Our emails are recorded. Our credit card purchases are recorded. Our movements, our social connections. All of this is stored in a huge complex in Utah. And they're doing this to people all over the world, their closest allies like Merkel. And this is now... all of this is unconstitutional. Every kind of invasion of privacy, of due process, of every constitutional right in the Bill of Rights is all strictly illegal, strictly unconstitutional, and nothing whatsoever has been done about it. Nothing. There's no constraint.
So what can we do? I mean, is there any way out of this mess?
I don't think so. I don't think there's any way out of that.
We're speaking today with Paul Craig Roberts about his insights on the many global developments and trends underway and in the news.
What I write about all the time is this, that if we set up our own monetary system, like publicly owned banks, and moved our money out of Wall Street and into our own banks, then the Wall Street banks would not be too big to fail. We could let them fail.
Anyhow. That's just a made-up thing for the power, to let them have more power. Of course they can fail. If they fail, there wouldn't be any consequences. It'd just be reorganized.
But I think, for example, in Greece, the reason I read somewhere that the Greeks didn't really have any choice but to capitulate because the central bank, or the ECB, had threatened to cut off their liquidity, and that's the way all banks are. I mean, the banks are all insolvent by nature because they lend out money that's supposed to be there for their depositors. And then they rely on this whole backup banking system.
Look,
isn't there.
Ellen, I think the work that you're doing is extremely important. But as I understand it, what it basically does is it prevents state budgets and state pension funds and state projects from being ripped off by the likes of Goldman Sachs.
Right.
And it imposed tremendous expenses on state and local governments that are then used to force them out of their pension obligations. Mm-hmm. So part of it is the Republican attack on the government employee unions. And this is valuable. I think every state should have the bank, like it's North Dakota, right?
Yeah.
They should all have that. It works fine, and it keeps them out of the clutches of banksters like Goldman Sachs. And all the kinds of problems that many states and cities have gone through are due to having been influenced by these big banks who are out to make a killing at the expense even of state governments. So that part of your work is absolutely essential, and I support it wholeheartedly.
I just wonder if Greece or somebody couldn't do the same thing. It seems like they could set up their own banks, publicly owned banks, that could get good rates from the ECB.
I really think that there's a much simpler solution, and that is you just exit the euro and go back to your own money. People are brainwashed. They're propagandized. Mm-hmm. They hear the same thing over and over and over for years and years and years. So don't think. They just say, we can't do that. But you can do it.
Right.
You used to do it. Before you got roped into the euro, you had your own central bank, your own money. You can do it again. And mm-hmm. if the Russians are giving them the opportunity, and they don't take it, then they deserve whatever happens to them, as far as I'm concerned. But to get on with the story that you asked me.
Yeah.
Because
okay,
you wanted
ahead.
To know what had happened from Reagan to now. And I told you
right.
the fundamental difference between Reagan and now, or between Reagan and 1991, is that the Soviet Union was still there. And the Soviet Union was a check on American power. And for Reagan, it was a potential conflict that could be become nuclear and end life. And so he wanted to end the conflict in order to avoid a nuclear Armageddon. Now, what caught everybody off guard and surprised them was the Soviet collapse in 1991. It was basically provoked internally when the hard communist right arrested the president, Gorbachev. And the country came to the defense of Gorbachev because he was trying to reform the system and he was making agreements with Reagan. And the result was the whole system collapsed and the drunkard Yeltsin ended up and he simply delivered Russia to the Americans. And essentially, Russia was a vassal state of the United States. Okay, now, when the Soviet collapse occurred, two things happened. The neocons said, oh, look, all the constraint on the United States is removed. We are now the unipower, the world's sole superpower. We have been chosen by history. You may remember the book Fukuyama wrote, The End of History. And what he means is that the conflict between socio-economic political systems is over, that history has decided. American democratic capitalism won. And therefore, the neoconservatives said, we are the exceptional, indispensable country, and history has given us the responsibility to impose our system on the rest of the world. And this means we are the hegemonic power. And then Wolfowitz, in I think 1992, wrote the Wolfowitz Doctrine that said the United States will not permit the rise of any other country that can control sufficient resources to be a check on American power. Now, this is the official foreign policy of the United States government. So, during the decade of American wars in the Middle East, where nothing went right, and 6-week wars became 8-year wars, and in Afghanistan, 14-year wars and continuing, during this time, Vladimir Putin appeared on the Russian scene, put Russia back together, created economic and military competence again, and suddenly the neoconservatives, who had been distracted with their adventures in the Middle East and Africa and worrying about China, said, oh my goodness, look, Russia just blocked our planned invasion of Syria. Look, they've blocked our planned bombing of Iran. They've come back, and now they have sufficient resources to be a constraint on our power. We can't tolerate this. We've got to get rid of them. What can we do? We'll have a coup in Ukraine. That'll cause them so much trouble, and not only that, we can use the coup because we control the explanations. English is the world language, not Russian. So the media cooperates with us, so we can do whatever we want, demonize Russia for it, and use the demonization to break off the economic and political relationships between Europe and Russia. We can isolate and marginalize Russia. We'll force sanctions on the Europeans that will break up their economic and political relations. We'll force Europe to impose sanctions on Russia that will break up their economic and political relations, keep Europe firmly under our thumb, and give Russia so many problems, and we'll go on from there. So that is the big transformation. That's the big difference. Nothing like this. Reagan had no ideology of world hegemony. And the other major consequence of the collapse of the Soviet Union was it caused socialist India and communist China to believe the neoconservatives that American capitalism was the only way to go. And so they opened up their massive, underutilized labor forces to Western capital. Previously, they had not. So now, Wall Street could go to American manufacturers and say, We want higher profits. Move your operations to China. Your labor costs will collapse, and your profits will go up dramatically, and we'll be happy. But if you don't do this, we're going to finance a takeover and take you over and do it. So the American manufacturers were forced offshore. Well, this destroyed the ladders of upward mobility. It collapsed the middle class. The well-paying manufacturing jobs with benefits lost. And then the next step, with the rise of the high-speed internet, was that the professional skill jobs, such as software engineering, information technology, that provided many jobs for American university graduates, these went offshore because they can be done anywhere and sent in on the high-speed internet. And so now we see a contracting, shrinking middle class, already some elements of it forced into near destitution. We see the amazing increase in the disparity in income and wealth. The United States has a worse income and wealth distribution than some outright gangster states. So these are the consequences of the Soviet collapse. It unleashed this dangerous ideology, neoconservative ideology, of American hegemony over the world, which is going to give us all kinds of wars and conflicts, and it unleashed the offshoring of the middle-class jobs, which are collapsing the American economy, because when you move middle-class jobs offshore, what do those people do? Well, according to payroll job statistics, they take part-time, lowly paid jobs in Walmart. And that will not support an individual existence. They can't form households. So the entire economy has been sacrificed to the profits of the manufacturing corporations and to the corporations that supply professional skills or tradable professional skills, such as engineering. So that is the story, you ask.
It's a really great explanation, totally discursive, a bit gloomy. But I don't know. I tend to be an optimist. I don't know why, but it does seem to me that we can work it out, and maybe what we have to do is wait for the whole thing to collapse or grab it just as it's going over the edge, although it seems to be pretty close to that now. But anyway, thank you so much for that wonderful explanation of where we are, where we've come from, how we've gotten here, and what's going on over there in Europe and Asia.
Well, it's a pleasure to speak with you, Ellen, and I thank you for the opportunity.
I've been speaking with Paul Craig Roberts, former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under Ronald Reagan and the author of 12 books, the latest of which is How America Was Lost from 9/11 to the Police Warfare State. And I think you can find everything about him on his website at
paulcraigroberts.org.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCreary. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.